It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. PFAS chemicals have been a growing concern in Wisconsin, with high levels found in groundwater and drinking water in many communities.
New research is tackling another question: are these forever chemicals showing up in people? A new study looked at the levels of PFAS in the blood of over 600 adults in Wisconsin.
These substances have been linked to cancer, changes in metabolism, and lower birth weight, among other complications.
The researchers were unable to make a direct cause and effect relationships, but the study did find out who is more likely to have higher PFAS levels, and that two foods in particular are linked to higher levels of the chemicals in a person's blood.
Amy Schultz is a researcher and co-author for that study, recently published in the Journal of Environmental Research. She's an epidemiology senior data scientist with the Real World Evidence to Advance Community Health, or REACH, program at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, happy to be here.
First of all, can you talk about the importance of trying to figure out, okay, is this PFAS that we know is in water in many places in Wisconsin is ending up in us?
Yeah, well, it's important for us to understand a baseline of prevalence of PFAS exposure. You know, how many people have detectable levels? What's the dose of exposure? How high are those levels? It enables us to continue to do research. You know, it lets us know, are there subpopulations that may be more exposed that we previously were unaware of outside of known contamination sites or areas of concern? And then it allows us to compare prevalence of PFAS exposure in a general Wisconsin adult sample to a national population. You know, are Wisconsinites more or less exposed to PFAS?
We're going to look at those results and see, you know, who seemed to have more PFAS in their blood, what things might be linked at it. Before we do that, I want to put a little asterisk on it, Amy. If I'm reading your research right, we're not seeing something where people should be alarmed about it, where if they say, oh, I eat that or I'm in that category, I should be really worried. Do I have that about right?
That's correct. This is an initial preliminary study that we use existing data. Mm-hmm. So it was an existing cohort of Wisconsin adults. They'd already provided survey data and interview data on behaviors, dietary information, demographics, and stored serum samples, blood samples, for research such as this one. But because the data we use was not specifically asked in such a way to get at all potential sources of PFAS, mm-hmm. there's, you know, potential associations we weren't able to uncover, and more research is needed to really understand the associations we did find.
Okay.
It's also important to note that this was just one point in time that we looked at PFAS exposure in. Exposures change over the course of time, depending on, you know, what products and occupations people have, for instance.
With those disclaimers out of the way, what kind of things stood out to you when you compared PFAS levels in the blood of people from, as you said, different demographic groups, people who lived and ate differently?
Yeah, so in our study sample, we looked at microwave popcorn consumption frequency, dental floss use, eating locally caught fish from inland water bodies, Great Lakes area, meat consumption, vegetable intake. We also looked at whether you get drinking water from a private well versus a municipality, fast food consumption. So we looked at a variety of factors that we had information on, and we wanted to see within our study sample, how did those that have higher levels of PFAS compared to those that had lower levels. And what we found was older age males, non-Hispanic white adults, those from higher household income, and those who eat locally caught fish were more likely to have higher serum PFAS within our study sample.
So let's look at the locally caught fish. Fish are in water. Makes sense. That's where we find a lot of PFAS. When we worry about things like mercury contamination, we might end up saying, hey, maybe we shouldn't be eating these fish. Again, if I'm reading your report right, we're not there at this point. There's some higher blood level of PFAS in people eating that locally caught fish. I'm not alarmed about eating that walleye at this point?
No, you should not be alarmed for several reasons. One is the information we had on eating locally caught fish wasn't very detailed. So we weren't able to look at how many locally caught fish you eat per year and if that's related to increased dose of PFAS exposure. We didn't look at type of fish or specific water bodies or waterways. Also, I should note that, as I said earlier, it's very possible those in our study sample that eat locally caught fish are also more likely to be exposed to PFAS via another source that we weren't able to look at. For example, they may be more likely to also eat store-bought, commercially bought fish, and maybe they're getting PFAS from that source, and that's explaining the association we're seeing. I'm not saying that's true, but we just don't know. So we would need to do a follow-up study to really understand the underlying factors with these associations. Another important point is the difference in overall PFAS we found among those who eat locally caught fish and those who don't may not be clinically meaningful, meaning having a PFOS level of 5.6 parts per billion on average compared to 4.2 might not mean that you have any increased risk of an adverse health effect. So that requires additional research as well. We just don't know at this time.
Talking to Amy Schultz, epidemiologist with UW-Madison's School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at one study that tried to get at the question, is PFAS in Wisconsin water ending up in Wisconsin people? And Amy, a lot of what we're saying here points toward the challenges of studying PFAS in our bloodstreams. This is kind of an opportunistic study. This is blood that had been sampled for something else. You went back and looked at it. With what you have in hand now, what would you want to see? What would be your ideal design for more studies that could drill deeper into these questions?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there are several ideal next steps. One would be to dive into the trends seen in this study by gathering more specific and detailed sources of exposure information. So actually measuring PFAS in drinking water from these participants, more detailed dietary items, occupational exposure, consumer products. We didn't ask about nonstick cookware use or anything like that. Also, you know, some of these associations, there's clear underlying factors. So higher household income itself does not give you PFAS, right? So what are the underlying factors or behaviors among those in our study sample with higher incomes that might be driving that? Also, this is a first look and provides a baseline. So now we can track changes in PFAS in the population over time. So in the next 5, 10, 15 years, do we see decreases in PFAS among our study sample, in specifically after EPA has passed, the Environmental Protection Agency in 2024, has ruled to regulate PFAS in several ways, such as drinking water standards and manufacturing and cleanup sites. So that's another area. And then expanding the research to include more adults, so a larger study sample, more adults from diverse racial and ethnic communities in Wisconsin, and also to more geographical regions in the state. This was demographically representative largely, but there are geographical representation that could be expanded.
And that I wanted to mention geography. We know there are many places in Wisconsin downstream, their groundwater is downstream in effect from sources, airports, manufacturing facilities that put a lot of PFAS into the environment. Would you see use in more intensive study, more sample collection from people who live in areas where we know there's a lot of PFAS in the water?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of utility in ensuring levels are going down as those sites are cleaned up, as they become regulated under the new EPA Superfund is now has two of the PFOS on the list to be under the cleanup site. So I think there will be a need for sampling in areas of known high exposure. The utility of doing a general sampling of PFOS prevalence among Wisconsin adults is also just to potentially understand if there are other subpopulations that stand out as having a higher exposure. We didn't see that, but we wanted to look, right? Because it's not just geography that's associated with PFAS exposure. It could be certain subpopulations or demographics that are exposed at higher levels because of different behaviors maybe cultural ones or consumer behaviors are different among different populations. And so we wanted to look at that as well.
Another challenge that pops in my head, and you've pointed toward this, I sometimes think PFAS is a thing. You've mentioned multiple times. There's hundreds of kinds of chemicals in these classes. Does that make it hard to test for all these different types of chemicals? Do we have tests that can test for lots of things, or are we doing them kind of one at a time?
That's a great question. PFAS exposure and the health effects associated with PFAS exposure are very difficult to specify for many reasons. There are actually at least 5,000 PFAS compounds, and they have varying toxicity levels, potentially varying health effects. And you're right in that most studies to date have focused on a limited number of better-known PFAS compounds. And that's largely because it's very expensive to test and to develop assays and tests to actually measure these in different analytes. So, I mean, like different mediums, so in blood versus in a food product or household dust or in water. So it's quite costly, and to get a large enough human study sample to donate blood, for instance, is also quite costly. There are potential findings from this study that are informative, in that one thing I haven't mentioned is that while over 96% of Wisconsin adults in our study sample had detectable levels for 6 PFAS compounds, for 8 of the PFAS compounds, no one in the study sample had detectable levels. And for an additional 9 PFAS compounds we looked at, fewer than 10 people had detectable levels. So there are PFAS compounds that either the half-life is short and they're not remaining in the body for very long, or exposure is very limited or very sparse, and it's not in a lot of consumer products.
And Amy, we'll leave it there. That's Amy Schultz, Epidemiology Senior Data Scientist with the Real World Evidence to Advance Community Health, or REACH program, at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about efforts to track PFAS in our bloodstreams.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, independent book publishers in our state are small but mighty in lifting up local authors.
We switched our model a little bit, and we really are focusing just on Wisconsin authors and Wisconsin books.
Hear from publishers in Mineral Point and Stevens Point on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A handful of companies are known as the Big Five Publishers.
Macmillan, HarperCollins, Penguin Random House, Hachette, and Simon & Schuster. Together, they make up the vast majority of best-selling books in the U.S.
But according to Publishers Weekly, there is a serious industry competitor.
Increasingly, authors are seeking out small independent publishers to take their work from manuscript to the shelf.
In Wisconsin, each year, dozens of books come from independent publishers that work to lift up Midwestern voices.
We dive into their work and the industry with Kristen Mitchell, the owner and founder of Little Creek Press in Mineral Point. Kristen, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And Ross Tangadal is an associate professor of English and director of the Cornerstone Press at UW-Stevens Point. Ross, welcome.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Ross, how are independent publishers different from the large commercial publishers or the Big Five?
Well, I can speak obviously from my own experience, but I feel like a lot of small presses operate under a similar set of, you know, guidelines or expectations. For instance, a lot of our titles are not agent represented or agent submitted. So a lot of our acquisitions are coming directly from, you know, would-be authors. And so right away, there's this connection between the publisher, the acquiring team, and the author, him or herself, as opposed to sometimes with agents, it's like there's a middle person and it's hard to find that initial relationship with the writer. So I think right away, that's a major difference for our team anyway, is that direct communication and relationship with authors.
Kristen, you found that the term independent publisher is difficult to define. Why is that?
I think because the transition or the growth of the publishing world has changed so dramatically in the last 10 years. For the longest time, it really was mainly the big publishers that has now been whittled down to five. And I think people were finding less opportunity with the big five or the big six or whatever it was at any given time. So I think then people started to look for other resources. Well, why can't we just do this ourselves? Why? So then that self-publishing model started to grow. And then trying to find a balance between the two of them, I think that's where the divergence, that's kind of where the independent publishing generally the model started and came from, is like, well, we can do all the services of a traditional publisher, but we're not going to buy the manuscript and we're not going to pay out advances, but we're going to, similar to what Ross said, work so closely with the author. So I think it's, you know, but independent publishers is a little bit of a broad term, I feel, because everybody's doing it maybe just a little bit different. The university presses are going to act a little bit different than my press, and my press is going to act a little bit differently than somebody who might be a very niche publisher. So I think it's that's why I think it's a little bit of a hard term to define.
Ross, Cornerstone being among just a handful of student-staffed presses in the country, how are students involved in the publishing process at Cornerstone?
They're involved in every department. So a traditional publishing house has editorial, production, marketing, sales, you name it. And students, as staff members of the press, while taking publishing classes, get to take a role that they want. So if they want to design book covers, they get to work for the production team. If they want to learn how to be editors, in order to become an editor, you actually have to edit things. And so they get a chance to edit manuscripts with our editorial team. If we have students that are really savvy with social media and more and are more marketing centric in their studies, hey, we've got a media team that needs to have materials made and connections made with authors. So honestly, when we say student staff press, we mean it. It's students involved in every facet of the publishing process.
And Cornerstone recently marking 40 years. How has interest in publishing changed over time? What have you seen?
There are so many writers in the United States, especially. And there's not always the opportunity for those writers to become published authors. And so certainly from what I've seen in my short 8 years here is that our number of submissions has just skyrocketed. There are so many people that have stories to tell, that have narratives that they've been working on, that maybe they've been publishing stories and poems in magazines and they want to try to make a book out of things. It's been so great to see the quality of submissions continue to improve year in and year out, because there are so many great writers out there that just haven't been given that opportunity yet.
That's exciting and hard all at once. Kristen, I would imagine you get lots of manuscript submissions each year. What goes into accepting one or denying one?
We do get a lot of submissions a year, and we earlier in the year, in this year, we switched our model a little bit, and we really are focusing just on Wisconsin authors and Wisconsin books. Mm-hmm. I honestly thought that maybe our submissions would dwindle a little bit because I was really kind of pulling in the focus, but it had the opposite effect, and we're getting, and to Ross's point, there are so many fantastic writers out there. When we get a submission, there's a team of us similar to Ross's team, and we all take a look at it. So the editor's going to look at it and do an editorial assessment. Is this book, does it align with what kind of books we want to publish? Is it a well-written book? And then really at its core, how much or how little work needs to be done to make it a really great published book? PR marketing steps in. Okay, is there a niche for this book? Is there going to be a built-in market? And if there's not, you know, and we still want to take it on, how do we pivot and make that work for the author? And then I kind of feel like my role is basically project management person, managing expectations person, is really just to kind of vet the author. I really want to get to know them. I want to know what their aspirations and their goals are. So I really, because we build relationships with these people, and we have to, the idea is that we have this great working relationship. So ultimately the author gets exactly what they need. And to get to that end goal, we have to make sure that we all, my whole team feels that this is the book that, you know, we really want to champion and put out into the world, and the author we want to work with.
If the author is flexible about their craft versus pretty rigid about what they've submitted, how do you interpret that?
Well, that's a good question, because it does happen where, you know, we can see opportunity for growth within a manuscript. And I'm always willing and happy to make the suggestions. I always ask first if they would like the feedback. And if they do want the feedback, if they're too rigid and really feel that their book is the best that it can be as it stands, then it's most likely not an author we're going to work with.
Ross, the publishing and editing process, as you know, can be tough. It can be subjective. There is feedback, as Kristen mentioned. How do you work with students on this aspect of publishing?
Absolutely. So again, what's really a unique part of our operations that we have undergraduate students working within the departments of the press. And so the way that my courses are set up is we have several days where we're only focusing on press-related materials. So the feedback that students receive, say, through the editorial department is really being given to them by our editorial director, who we recently hired. He was an undergrad for me for 2 years. And then now we created a position so that we could hire out an editorial director to assist with our really, really impressive growing list. And so now he, Brett Hill, will be in charge of training and orienting our new editorial assistants. And so the feedback really comes from trust. I, since the day I got here, trust that my students are adults and I will treat them that way. And therefore, much is expected of them. And every single time that I've done that, the students rise to the occasion. You have to give them the opportunity to both fail and succeed, but every single time they succeed, in my estimation. So that's really how we build not only relationships with authors, but how I then build relationships with these students who are learning the trade.
We're talking about independent and small publishers in Wisconsin with two industry leaders. That is Ross Tangadal, who is an associate professor of English and director of the Cornerstone Press at UW-Stevens Point. We have Kristen Mitchell with us, the owner and founder of Little Creek Press in Mineral Point. Kristen, some indie publishers in the state specialize in niche genres, topics like nautical books or medical physics, or there's Shields Publications in Eagle River specializing in earthworm publishing. How do these niche publishers fit into the publishing world?
So I think sometimes they're born out of necessity or serving that need. Many, and I'm being very broad in this, but I think that a lot of times, oftentimes, those publishing companies are started very specifically to fill that niche, that need. Oftentimes, it's an author-run publishing company. I know of several publishing companies that were started because the author couldn't find a publisher that they could align with and decided to start their own imprint so that they could publish their own books. And then I think they build on that, right? They've built a niche, and then other people that may fall into that specific category can come to them and then also be published. So, I mean, we're all valuable. There's value in all of our models.
Ross at Cornerstone Press, working to elevate that Midwestern voice, the Wisconsin authors. How might stories from Midwesterners differ from stories that you would get from the coast?
Sure. So, you know, we hate to be stereotypical of either the coasts or the Midwest, but we consider the Midwest, you know, flyover country, the heartland, all of these kind of stereotypes of what the Midwest is. It's a simple place. It's not a place of vibrancy or culture. And of course, we all know that to be false, right? Especially those of us that live in the Midwest. And so I feel, and I grew up in the West, I'm from Montana, yet I've been a Midwestern transplant now for over a decade. And I very much associate with being a Midwesterner because the stories that are told by people from this region have just as much vibrancy, culture, and intentionality as those from New York City or from Los Angeles. And so Midwestern voices need a space where they can be elevated. And if the independent book industry can be part of that space, that's wonderful. We need to elevate more voices, not exclude more voices.
Okay, so we've gotten to the point here, Kristen, where you can elevate a voice. Can you give us an example of a memorable book published through your press?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is the Dane County Farmers Market Cookbook, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Dane County Farmers Market. So that's the kind of the epitome of what kind of elevation we're talking about with Midwestern voices. Therese Allen authored the book, worked closely with the Farmers Market board. And that has been one of our best-selling books. We're on our second run. We do traditional print runs and we do print on demand. And it's been our, we're on our second run of 5,000 books within, we released it in July of 2023. So, it's the opportunity to, on a global scale, share what Dane County and Wisconsin has to offer in that food scape, so to speak.
That must make you feel really good, because for each manuscript, you really have to think through the future and what could happen if it is published, like the financials and the numbers. And you have to run all of that alongside a compelling manuscript. What is that like for you?
Well, I find it to be extraordinarily fun because a lot of our job is to like see the potential, think long term, see the potential, just not now, but what is this going to do for our author, their platform, their life now, but in the future? Is this the first book in the series? Is this their trial at really putting out their shingle as an author? Who are they going to touch? For how long are they going to touch people? How are these books and words going to affect? How many people are going to cook these recipes?
Ross, can you give us an example of a memorable book published through Cornerstone?
This is like trying to pick your favorite child. Honestly, we work with so many books now. When I took over the position in 2016, we were publishing one book a year. So I would have a very easy answer there, because one book a year only makes for so many total books over time. But we've since expanded to, 20, 30, 40 books a year over the last several years. So with all of our genres and all of our authors from various states, I'm honestly proud of all of them. But for a few, the Wisconsin Poet Laureate, Margaret Rozga, we've published two of her books, her collected poems, Holding Myself Together, here a couple of years ago, and then her most recent collection, Restoring Prairie. So proud to be associated with not only Margaret as a poet, who's just a wonderful Wisconsin poet, but also the Wisconsin Poet Laureate Commission. That's been a really wonderful relationship. And then in terms of stories, I do have a soft spot for my Wisconsin writers, my Wisconsin short story writers. Kim Suhr is putting out her second collection with us, Close Call, here in a month. And her short story collection, Nothing to Lose, was one of our best sellers when it came out a few years ago. So, but I could sit and tell you so many stories of every individual author, every individual book that we've worked on since 2016. So it's been a wonderful ride thus far.
May I ask how you have been able to scale up in such a way?
Sure. So one, we've expanded the amount of classes that we offer for publishing students. So instead of having one class per year, we have one every semester. They're all filled with 20 to 23 students. So that right there expands your staff considerably. I've also just created more of a space where we can see authors in different networks. And so instead of trying to do all of our work and all of our sales right here in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, we're getting authors from Ohio, from California, from New York, from Indiana, because each network for each author yields significant benefits, whether it's sales or prestige or reviews. And so just slowly but surely now into a larger operation, we have the staff for it. We have the bandwidth for it, the support from our university, which has been considerable. And now, of course, the different networks of writers that we work with.
I do want to ask about AI before we go here. The AI publishing website says it has a place for authors to help build books to boost sales, full manuscripts, proofreading, personalizing writing, brainstorming book ideas. Kristen, you first, how do you think about AI incorporating into the publishing world?
I was very wary, but I have recently been using AI. So I'm a graphic designer by trade. It's I've been doing it for over 30 years. And I have seen the opportunity with AI for cover designs. So a whole new world has opened up to me as a designer of some fantastic book covers. So I can see the advantage of using it in that way. I am a little wary still. I don't know how. I understand the capabilities of AI peripherally, but I don't know how it's going to translate to the written word. I honestly don't have a good answer for that, because I'm skeptical. And I think it's going to get harder and harder to discern AI versus not AI. Yeah. And even I've noticed, even when we use Ingram for distribution, I've even noticed now when I'm uploading a book file, That's one of most of my platforms now have that question. Was AI used in any form of creation of this book?
Wow.
So I think that is telling that we're just kind of on the beginning of who knows what's coming, but we're already starting to see adaptations to weed out whether or not it was created in AI.
Ross, your thoughts?
I've always told students that the greatest invention in human history was the book. The very idea that we can catalog human striving and human emotion and story and narrative through this physical object that is labored over not only by a writer who writes, but by compositors, typesetters, book designers, marketers, booksellers. Writing is the essential act of the human. And I think that though AI is becoming part of our regular lives, and there's ways in which, of course, you should utilize technology to your benefit. John Berryman, the poet, he said that we flash and yearn as humans. Humans flash and yearn. And I would rather see the flashing and yearning of a writer struggling to write and then creating something out of their flashing and yearning than just seeing something that's been spit out by a machine that has no heart and has no brain. So we are very much about telling human stories by humans for humans.
Ross and Kristen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Kristen Mitchell is owner and founder of Little Creek Press in Mineral Point, and Ross Tangadal is an associate professor of English and director of the Cornerstone Press at UW-Stevens Point.
Coming up, two athletes from Superior led a world championship team in broomball.
Everyone wants you to be there. Everyone takes care of you, even on the opposing teams that are out there. So it's been a really cool process to get to know all the people involved in the sport.
Find out more about the sport and their experiences coming up on Wisconsin Today. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about discovering who you truly are.
While Joseph Ray Torres of Oneida was on his path of self-discovery, something finally clicked for him. He realized he was two-spirit, which for him meant embracing masculine and feminine identities. Torres talked about this with his adopted nephew and mentee, Corey Carline of Green Bay, during a StoryCorps mobile tour stop in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
My name is Corey. I am 33 years old. I am an Indigenous Mexican student, doctoral candidate at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay.
My name is Joseph, age 58. I'm a recent graduate from UWGB. I graduated with a double major in First Nations Studies and Business Administration. I am also Indigenous and Mexican. I identify as a proud two-spirit gay man as well.
When you were growing up, what did your Indigenous identities mean to you?
My mom, she went to a mission school, and so I was raised very Christian, and my dad was Mexican and Pueblo from Dallas, Texas. Because they both dealt with so much racism, even though my mom spoke full-blooded Oneida, she never spoke it to us, and my dad, who was his first language was Spanish, he would not speak it to us. They were both very loving, hardworking parents. But at the same time, I look back and I feel a little bit cheated, not because of anything they did, just because of what they went through. They didn't want us kids to go through that. But I guess I saw other Oneidas and I knew I was Oneida, but I didn't really know what it meant until years later.
What do these identities mean to you now?
Well, they help me keep grounded. They help give me self-confidence. they let me know that I have a place in society, you know, and then coming out as well was very hard. My family took it really well. And my mom, of course, being Christian, was the one that had the hardest time dealing with it. And I was really close to my mom. But because of her Christianity, her response was, believe in the power of prayer. You know, and one of the best gifts I ever received, a friend gave me a book by Walter Williams called Sexual Diversity in Native American Culture, The Flesh and the Spirit. And that really empowered me, gave me an identity that more than anything confirmed that a long time ago before Europeans, Christianity, colonization, Two-Spirit people were revered. It was believed we were given special gifts. And we were given very high roles in our society. There was no such thing as coming out. It just was. It was believed that the Creator made us, and it was also considered to be gifted because we could understand both the masculine and the feminine side of things. And a lot of times when kids were left orphaned, they were given to a Two-Spirit individual, because in Native American culture, they thought, what better to raise a child than someone that has both the feminine and masculine energy to be both the mother and the father. So, and then just learning more about my culture, just reading books on my own, and especially going to UWGB and majoring in First Nation Studies, I really learned a lot more about my own Oneida culture specifically. It means a lot to me now. I'm proud to be Mexican, Pueblo, Oneida, Two-Spirit, proud to be gay, proud to be everything that I am.
I've had the life-changing gift of your mentorship and advice for as long as I can remember.
Well, I'm very proud of you. You've come a long, long way. So
we're all proud of you, too.
That was Joseph Ray Torres of Oneida and Corey Carline of Green Bay. Their interview was recorded at StoryCorps, a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of WPR and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
This is Wisconsin Today. The sport of broomball has a new world champion, and the winning team for the United States features two stars from Wisconsin.
The co-ed team Squall USA is mostly men and women from the Twin Cities, but their leading scorers in the World Championship tournament in France last month are from Superior.
Aiden Bashand and Blake Hansen are broomball players from Superior who grew up playing sports together and are now world champions. Aiden and Blake, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, appreciate the time. Thanks.
Aiden, let's start by painting a picture for people who haven't seen broomball in action. What is it? How does it work?
Yeah, absolutely. Broomball is played with on ice with a stick and a ball, more or less with a paddled shaped end stick, if you will. Played on ice with special shoes, so it's not like skates. And it's kind of a combination of hockey and soccer, a little bit of, you could call it golf and lacrosse in there, you could say. So I guess to me, it's kind of a combination of everything. If you're a hockey player, soccer player, anything like that, you can definitely pick up the sport pretty fast.
And Blake, I've watched some video. It has some rhythm of hockey to it, definitely. And at least, I don't know if all leagues play like this. This is, or can be, a contact sport, right?
Correct. Yeah. At this point, it's mostly just like for the men's international game, they do contact. Most of the time in the States, it's contact-free, even if you're playing men's. But it's very, very similar to hockey and the flow of the game and how you set up for everything.
And Blake, how did you get into broomball in the first place?
Yeah, it's a fun little story. Aiden introduced it to me a few years ago now. His parents had grown up playing it, so he was kind of experienced in how to play the game and got into it a little bit before I did. But after I was done playing college soccer, he introduced it to me when I had some free time and picked it up since then and loved every second of it.
And Aiden, you grew up with the game. Talk a little bit about your earliest memories of playing broomball.
Yeah, I have quite the story of earliest memories. Right now, it's I guess both parents played. My dad played at a higher level, broomball. Went and played in all the international tournaments and up in Canada and all that good stuff. One of the most fond memories up in Duluth actually was I was watching a game when I was 5 years old or 6 years old. Can't remember, but the rink actually ended up blowing up during one of my dad's
What?
broomball games. The Zamboni actually blew up on the ice. Yeah, it was the Peterson Ice Arena. Totally, it's the story out there. You could go look it up. But that's one of my most fond memories of broomball. That yeah, no one got killed, none of that
Good.
stuff. But it was quite the experience. It was just my brother and my mom and us watching in the stands, a couple other people in the stands, and everyone got out all right. But yeah, it was quite the total loss of the rink. But yeah, total broomball moment when I was 5 or 6 years old. But then, like I said, I had a hockey career. And a soccer career as well, and kind of transitioned into broomball after college as well. So
And Blake, watching again just on video, it looks like a workout as a soccer player yourself. How does broomball compare in terms of strenuous athleticism on the ice?
it is very much a workout. Yeah, it is, something like I'm used to it for soccer, obviously, but it's a very different kind of sport, different muscles that you use for broomball as opposed to soccer or even hockey, because you just have special shoes that don't really grip the ice too well. It's a lot of the stabilization muscles and like your core and kind of your hips and everything. It gets a lot more activation in that. So it definitely took me a while to build up those muscles and get used to it, but it is a great workout.
And Blake, I assume you guys get asked this all the time. As people here in Wisconsin are used to walking on the ice, I know what you're talking about, those different muscles. Like, how slippery is it? How much are those shoes keeping you from sliding on the ice versus how much of that is your balance and your core strength keeping you up?
Yeah, so it definitely is it's a learning process. So when you first start, it takes a while for you to get acclimated to, what to expect on the ice, even with the spongy shoes. But a good pair of shoes makes all the difference. I remember when I first started, I was just using leftover pairs that were just kind of there for anyone to use, and they're pretty worn out. Second, you buy some new shoes that are pretty nice, it is an entirely different game. It's not quite to the level of, being out on a soccer field where you have good traction, but it is definitely a difference maker.
Okay, let's bring Team Squall into this, Aiden. How did you get hooked up with this team that ended up competing internationally?
Yeah, so down in the Twin Cities, that's where majority of the US tournaments take place, or the bigger tournaments take place. And I play with a team out of Indiana that I got picked up on a couple of years ago for the men's division. And for the co-rec division, I got picked up on the Team Squall. So Team Squall technically plays in all the US tournaments for the co-rec division, mixed division. And the Sheila Chang, who runs the Squall team, asked if we wanted to go over to France. My initial answer was no. I'm not much for traveling. After some consideration and asking Blake to go play with me, traveling together, that type of thing, as I've never been over the pond before. So definitely, I'm glad I did it. It was an amazing experience. And so Team Squall has played together before. We won a national championship together over in the US last year and the year before. So definitely a team that's played together before, but just going over and playing some different teams from all the different countries was a quite the experience.
We're talking about the sport of broomball with world champions Aiden Bashand and Blake Hansen from Superior. Blake, you were on Team Squall going to France. What was it like playing now on an international stage, representing the U.S. against teams from around the world?
It was great. This was my first, major tournament other than the US Nationals. I've played with the men's team for a couple of years, but it was really something special for me to be able to go over to France again, like Aiden kind of shared as well. It was my first time being abroad over there, and being able to represent the country was something very cool.
And Aiden, you're used to playing teams here in the US. Are there, do other teams come in with different philosophies, formations, strategies, things like that that you had to get used to?
Of course, yeah, it's definitely a difference. The sport differs through all different, you know, I think we're the most competitive along with Team Canada or the teams in Canada. We're the most competitive when it comes to broomball. You know, the other teams that are from Australia, Switzerland, Italy, Germany, even France, you know, I'm not sure how, you know, big the sport is in these other countries, but it was super cool to play against some of the other teams and see how they, you know, the different, like you said, formations that they play. It was a little difference, yes, but for the most part, everyone plays kind of the same strategies. So,
and Blake, again, coming from the soccer world, how much does it take to get the team together playing on the same page so you know what the person on the other side of the ice is about to do, say, before you make that pass?
Yeah, it's the same with any sport. You know, you just need time together with the teammates that you're playing with before you can actually start to understand where they're going to be, what they like to do, that kind of thing. For us, we had, you know, several practices leading up to the world tournaments over in France where we kind of were able to feel each other out and learn what each of us wanted to do on the ice. Aiden and I got to pick our line mate as well, which kind of helped with that. So we knew what to expect from her as well coming in.
So Blake, as a more recent convert to the sport, what would you say to encourage other people to check out playing broomball?
I'd say just give it a try. You know, it's a great sport full of great people, especially in the U.S. I can't speak to Canada and other countries, but the broomball culture that we have in the U.S. is really great. And it's super easy to get involved, especially in some of the bigger cities. You know, there's usually stuff going on, even if you've never heard of it before. So I encourage everyone to just go out, give it a try. If you like it, stick around. We'll always be here for you to play.
And Aiden, you've been watching the sport, like you said, since you were a kid in the era of the exploding Zamboni. How have you seen the popularity of broomball rise and or fall over the years?
Yeah, I'd say it was much more popular, especially around the Twin Ports area where we're from, much more popular pre-COVID, I'd say. I think COVID kind of took a turn for the worse for the sport just because, again, popularity dropped. I think a lot of the older guys decided either to retire or just kind of be done with it. And I think that second generation, I think it's starting to gain a little more traction. Really where broomball gains a lot of traction through is, hey, after my college career, like Blake said, after college soccer, hockey, whatever it is done. And they're kind of looking to stay in shape, get into a team sport, still be competitive. That's what this sport is for. I think it's a good home for those types of people that are not looking to join the hockey leagues, the soccer leagues after the fact. They're looking for something a little different. And like Blake had said, the community of broomball is just amazing. Coming from the hockey community, the soccer communities, broomball is nothing like it. Everyone wants you to be there. Everyone takes care of you, even on the opposing teams that are out there. So it's been a really cool process to get to know all the people involved in the sport.
We'll leave it there. Aiden, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thank you.
And Blake, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for the time. Appreciate it.
Aiden Bichand and Blake Hansen are broomball players from Superior. They won the World Championship of Broomball as part of Team Squall last month at a tournament in France. They're with us today to share their experience and tell us more about the sport.
It's Black Friday, traditionally the single biggest shopping day of the year, albeit arriving a little bit late this year.
And we want to know, do you get into the shopping frenzy? Are you listening to us as you go from store to store or as you stand in line? Or maybe you stay home and avoid the rush of shoppers.
How about you, Rob? What is your Black Friday approach?
I don't go. I don't like crowded stores, so I steer well clear.
Okay, well, share your experiences and your thoughts. Call or text us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Or you can email us about Black Friday and your holiday shopping approach at wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.